Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
Listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 507. I'm Amy Matheny, and wow, I'm going to bring it down now. I'm usually so excited. We have a very exciting show, it's true, but it's also, you know, whenever you're listening to this Queercast, because you can listen to it anytime the week before Valentine's Day, I just thought I would be of service to you and think of bringing the sexy back to the show. And also think of, you know, who might be a sexpert or a sexy gal that could be on my show to talk about, you know, what you want to do for your lover, what you want to do with your lovers. I don't know. Whatever twirls your tassels. And there's my little hint as to who I have on the show with me. Michelle L'Amour is just going to be on with me here at the top of the show. She was Miss Exotic World 2005. We're so happy she has her home here in Chicago with Studio L'Amour, where you can, too, learn all the wonders of burlesque, which I have been indoctrinated to by Ms. L'Amour. And she, of course, fostered the Chicago Starlettes and has these wonderful burlesque shows that we're so lucky to have here in Chicago. And I thought, let's have Michelle on to talk about the sexy. Hey, Michelle, how are you?
Hey, Amy. I'm good. Thank you.
It's so great to talk to you. You know, I got to catch your last show and up at the wonderful main stage, which is a beautiful facility. And I just love how so many things encompass the sexy in the world of burlesque. And I love that. What do you think makes burlesque so special and so sexy?
Well, I think burlesque has a lot of layers to it, pun intended, I suppose. you have your humor and your satire and your intelligence and, of course, your sexy, and it all comes together to make just an explosion of awesome in the space. When I think about doing shows for the audience, I think that I just want to assault your face for about an hour and a half with as much feathers and sparkles as I can put up on that stage.
Wait, I'm sorry. I lost you at assault my face. And we're done. That's all we need to say about the sexy for Amy for the next days heading into Valentine's Day. Well, I mean, you have really been keeping it alive and you know, the sexy in Chicago, because it can be a cold town, a cold, windy city, but things really heat up if you're in one of Michelle's classes, the Naked Girls reading salons, one of the shows. I mean, you really do know how to make a chilly night feel warm. Now, can you be sexy even if you're, not having a special significant other this Valentine's Day, or you're not sure if you're going to have a special significant tryst perhaps this Valentine's Day? How do we keep the sexy alive just for ourselves?
Of course. I think, you know, getting together with friends is fun, but if that's too much social activity on a cold night, a nice bath, some oils, nice reading. Of course, I'm, you know, always advocating reading naked, whether mm-hmm. by yourself or with others. so, you know, I think that's nice and romantic.
Yeah, I agree. And do you have like a favorite Valentine's memory? Is there something, I think with other people, I'd say, what was your favorite Christmas gift? And with Michelle L'Amour, I really want to know, like, what was the best Valentine's?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Valentine's Day or surrounding days, I'm usually doing the show.
Yep.
And I kind of forget that it's actually Valentine's Day because I'm so engrossed in the show and making the show happen and getting ready. And It's always very nice, but Frankie, my husband, always gets me a gift on Valentine's Day. Even though we say, you know, don't, we are doing the show, we're too busy, da da da, he always remembers to get me something really sweet and very special, and then I go, oh yeah, I forgot. And so, you know, he's left without a gift. So mm-hmm. I usually end up unwrapping myself. So it works out.
You're usually the gift that keeps on giving. You know what
That's
love
right.
is that I can equate what you're saying about Valentine's Day, because I know it's a really peak time of year for you and the starlets and the studio and everyone, because you're helping everybody get their sexy on. And then you're also
That's
entertaining
right.
and performing for others. But it's kind of how I feel around Gay Pride. I kind of often don't feel like going out and being in the middle of the parade because I feel like I'm a gay pride parade, like 360, you know, plus days
yeah.
of the year. So it's like that one day I kind of go, okay, you guys got it. Okay, good. There's a big parade. Good. I'm just going to like lay down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I've done all the pre-work. Now it's time for you to do your thing and yeah. go for it. Yeah, for
well,
sure.
I am so excited that you have a Valentine's Day show coming up. And I've already told all my lady friends, gay and straight. And I guess I should start telling my guy friends, too, especially my straight guy friends. But also now you're bringing the guys to the stage, which we love, with the Stage Door Johnnies you've had performing mm-hmm. with you. And Mr. Gorgeous is performing yeah. with you.
Mr. Gorgeous certainly lives up to his name. He is ridiculous. You should definitely tell all your guy friends, gay or straight, because this guy, it just doesn't even make any sense how he looks like this.
Well, and it's all going to be happening in one big sexy show. It's called The Big Sexy Show, of course, produced by Frankie and Michelle. It's on Valentine's Day. So if you're looking for something to do, and let me tell you, they're going to a big, luscious venue. They're going to be at the Park West, where it just feels sexy in there, right? It's very deco.
Yeah.
There's tables. There's little nooks where you can sit in booths, but it's really big.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the velvet booths and just the little lamps at your table. It just is perfect. It's this Valentine's Day. So get your tickets now, folks. It's for The Big Sexy Show, February 14th on Thursday night, 8 o'clock at the Park West, with Michelle L'Amour, the starlets. As we said, Mr. Gorgeous will be there.
And it's hosted by Cameron Esposito,
yeah.
who is a wonderful stand-up comic, and I'm really excited to have her back.
She is funny and funny and queer, and we love that about her. For people to get tickets, what is the best way? Do they contact the Park West, or do they go through you?
Yes, you can contact the Park West, or I have a link up on my website, michellelamour.com.
Great. We will have that in our show notes. So, folks, you can go to our Windy City Queercast page, and we'll click you right through to Michelle's page where you can get tickets this week and get them soon so you can snuggle in with a nice cocktail or a hot toddy or whatever you want, and with your lover or a stranger. Who knows?
Oh, my.
Everyone should get laid on Valentine's Day. I really believe that, even if you're in a hot bathtub by yourself reading naked. I mean, you know.
Exactly.
This is what I'm saying. But you should go to the hot bath after or before the big sexy show, folks. If you are listening and you can get to Chicago, do not miss it. And Michelle, thank you so much for the sexy that you bring to Chicago and to all of us throughout the year.
Thank you so much. You know, this is my 10th anniversary of bringing the sexy, and I'm really excited about it.
10 years, you're entitled to be quite sexy and quite excited about it. And everybody, guess what else? I'm super excited just to share the love this time with the publisher and owner of Windy City Times, Tracy Baim, who has so much energy. I don't know how she does it, folks, but I just appreciate that she could stop by and talk with me a little bit about her new big venture. Last time it was a movie. I happened to be in it, which was a joy. This time it's a book. I bought it at Women and Children First and put it on my shelf. And it's a little bit about something I know something about. It's called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. And that's something Tracy Baim knows a lot about, too. So we've got gay news, gay theater and art, what's going on in that scene, and Tracy Baim all on the Queercast.
Glamour, romance, and sensuality. See the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends. Jerome Robbins' Interplay conveys the wonderful playfulness and unfettered curiosity of youth. Gerald Arpino's lush duet, Sea Shadow, honors the 90th anniversary of his birth. The voice of Frank Sinatra sets you swinging in Twyla Tharp's classic Nine Sinatra Songs, costumed by Oscar De La Renta. Stanton Welch's exuberant and theatrical Son of Chambers Symphony makes it Chicago premiere. It's the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, February 13th through the 24th. For tickets, call 800-982-2787 or visit joffrey.org.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News. In Wisconsin, five suspects now face murder charges in the disappearance case of transgender rapper Ebony Evan Young. Billy Griffin, 28. Ashanti McAllister, 18, and Victor Stewart, 27, each now face murder charges. Ron Allen, 37, and Devin Seabury, 23, were charged after an investigation into the disappearance of Young, who has been missing since January 2nd. The men allegedly struck and shot Young, with the victim's body put in a dumpster that was set on fire.
The Boy Scouts of America could be ending its longtime ban on gay scouts, the organization announced on January 28th. Darren Smith, director of PR for the BSA, said that the Boy Scouts was discussing removing the national restrictions on sexual orientation, and even President Obama added his support on Sunday that scouting should be open to everyone.
The Last Closet, a web-based campaign and video project to combat homophobia in sports, launched a new campaign asking professional sports team owners to speak out about the issue. This is the second in a series of campaigns designed to promote dialogue about homophobia among the sports hierarchy, and now paves the way for the first athlete in one of the top five U.S. pro sports leagues to come out publicly while actively playing.
The Senate sponsor behind a bill that would legalize same-sex marriage in Illinois says she hopes to move the bill shortly after the Senate returns in February. State Senator Heather Steen said that she is currently working on revisions to the bill.
In Virginia, four Republicans joined all of the Democrat state senators to pass an employment non-discrimination guarantee for LGBT people. However, there may be difficulty with the House of Delegates in the more conservative chamber. The state's governors had a recent history of working around the legislature by issuing executive orders barring anti-gay discrimination by state employees.
The Connecticut House and Senate confirmed former state senator Andrew McDonald as the associate Supreme Court justice, making him the state's first openly gay justice. Governor Dan Malloy nominated McDonald as a candidate last December. McDonald served as senator for 8 years before becoming the governor's legal counsel.
In Kentucky, gay preacher Reverend Maurice Bojangles Blanchard and his partner, Dominique James, were arrested after refusing to leave a county clerk's office that denied them a marriage license. Officers arrived to arrest the couple for trespassing when they remained in the Jefferson County clerk's office after it had closed for the day. Same-sex marriages and civil unions were outlawed in Kentucky in 2004 because of an amendment to the state's constitution.
After a three-year run as a paid contributor to the nation's highest-rated cable news channel, Sarah Palin and Fox News have severed ties. After resigning as governor in 2009, Palin became one of the news channel's on-air assets.
Former pro football player Kwame Harris faces felony domestic violence charges for allegedly beating an ex-boyfriend in the parking lot of a Menlo Park, California restaurant. The 30-year-old Harris, who played with the San Francisco 49ers and Oakland Raiders, was charged with felony domestic violence and assault causing great bodily injury. He faces up to 9 years in prison if found guilty. Harris's attorney said it's a case of self-defense.
In Illinois, three St. Charles residents have been charged with a hate crime in connection with a violent attack on a group of people while taunting two men in the group for being gay. The residents, Stephen Bolt, Christopher Miner, and Susan Patton, are each charged with two counts of felony hate crime, as well as two counts of aggravated battery and one count of mob action.
On Dr. Phil McGraw's talk show, Ronaya Tuiasosopo, who admitted to fabricating Notre Dame linebacker Manti Te'o's fake girlfriend in an elaborate hoax, said he felt a deep romantic love for the football player. McGraw said on Today, "Here we have a young man that fell deeply romantically in love." Te'o told talk show host Katie Couric that he is not gay.
Miami Beach, Florida is asking the Food and Drug Administration to let gay people donate blood. The city commission unanimously passed a resolution on January 16th. In the United States, any man who has had sex with another man since 1977 is banned for life from donating blood. The federal policy was enacted in 1985 when the risk of AIDS from transfusions was first acknowledged.
Flagstaff, Arizona has advanced a gay rights measure that would actually protect sexual preference, gender identity, and veterans from discrimination in employment and public accommodations. However, the new ordinance exempts state, county, and federal agencies operating inside the city limits, religious-based organizations, expressive groups like the Boy Scouts, and businesses with fewer than 15 employees.
In Oregon, gay teenager Jaden Bell died after a suicide attempt that took place in the schoolyard of an elementary school. Bell hung himself on January 19th, but was taken off life support January 29th. Family and friends said the boy was the target of vicious bullying, both at school and online. Bell had reportedly begged his parents for homeschooling. When that failed, he appealed to school administrators for help.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has named his choice for the interim replacement for outgoing United States Senator John Kerry, and it is not openly gay former Congressman Barney Frank. Patrick chose William Mo Cowan, his former chief of staff, to fill the open seat vacated by Kerry.
A bill that would have allowed same-sex couples in Wyoming to create domestic partnerships carrying most of the legal rights of marriage died by a vote of 35-24 in the state house. The vote came just 2 days after a House committee shot down the full marriage equality bill by a 5-4 vote. Meanwhile, a bill that would ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is headed to the state Senate.
In world news, in the United Kingdom, the bill that would establish marriage equality has been introduced in Parliament. Debate on the bill and a vote are scheduled for February 5th. Although some religious conservatives oppose the measure, it is likely to pass, as it has the backing of Prime Minister David Cameron and other national leaders.
In France, a poll showed that 63% of the country's residents back marriage equality. The poll results were revealed after a quarter of a million people marched in favor of same-sex marriage on January 27th and before a parliamentary debate on January 29th on the bill known as Marriage for All.
The State Duma, the lower house of Russia's parliament, approved legislation 388-1 that would ban LGBT events or public discussion of LGBT issues that minors could access. The so-called gay propaganda bill is a national version of the one that St. Petersburg has already adopted. Activists for and against the bill demonstrated outside the State Duma's headquarters in Moscow.
In support of the LGBT community, Venice, Italy is seeking to cut ties with its Russian sister city, St. Petersburg, because of that city's anti-gay legislation. On January 28th, the Venice City Council unanimously approved a motion asking officials to cease cultural exchanges as long as anti-gay laws are in place. In 2006, the two cities signed an agreement to pursue cultural and further exchanges.
In entertainment news, out former talk show host Nate Berkus has landed a job in primetime. Berkus will host a new NBC series tentatively called Home Transformers. Home Transformers is billed as a competition reality show. However, unlike most shows of that type, it will feature professionals instead of amateurs.
HBO has renewed the show Girls for a third season for 12 episodes. The premiere episode of the second season already exceeded a gross audience of 3.8 million viewers. Created by and starring Lena Dunham, Girls recently won two Golden Globes.
Out R&B singer Frank Ocean and musician Chris Brown, along with their respective entourages, reportedly brawled outside a recording studio. Ocean reportedly wants to press charges.
Barbra Streisand is set to perform on this year's Oscars telecast, February 24th. It will be the legendary actress's second time ever singing at the Oscars. The previous time was in 1977, where she sang the love theme from A Star is Born.
Jim Nabors, the actor best known for playing Gomer Pyle on TV in the 1960s, has married his longtime male partner. Nabors, who is 82, and Stan Cadwallader, who is 64, traveled from their Honolulu home to Seattle to be married on January 15th. The couple met in 1975 when Cadwallader was a Honolulu firefighter. Nabors said he'd been open about his homosexuality to coworkers and friends, but never acknowledged it to the media before.
And two-time Tony Award-winning actress Patti LuPone will return to Carnegie Hall during the New York venue's 2013-2014 season. LuPone will perform a special one-night-only concert, Far Away Places, on November 7th.
And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hi, this is Patrick Bristow, and you are listening to the Windy City Queercast. What do you think of that?
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of February 4th, 2013, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Goodman Theater presents Teddy Ferrara, a gripping new drama by Christopher Shin. It's Gabe's senior year of college, and his future looks bright. He runs the queer student group, and he recently started dating a great guy. But when a campus tragedy occurs, it ignites a firestorm and throws Gabe's world into disorder. Teddy Ferrara is running now through March 3rd. Get your tickets today at goodmantheater.org.
Tickets are going fast for The Letters, a smart, sexy thriller of politics and disinformation, now playing at Writers Theatre's intimate Books on Vernon Space in Glencoe. The Tribune calls The Letters a taut, personal dance of menace and the ideal selection for this space and these actors. And the Sun-Times adds The Letters is mesmerizing. Get your tickets today for The Letters at writerstheatre.org.
Chicago Shakespeare Theater's unforgettable season continues with Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's epic tale of ambition, betrayal, and consequence. Don't miss the most enduring political thriller in history, now playing through March 24th. Visit ChicagoShakes.com for more information on Julius Caesar. And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hi there, this is Deb Pierce reminding you it's okay. Go ahead. You're not alone. Post a comment.
Serve me well as a learning tool, sometimes even better than school, though it helps to carry a warning sign. Know when you gotta read between the lines. A certain story will catch your eye, the who, what, where, when, and why. Wanna know more than they'll tell? That's the way these papers sell.
The sparks that flew I remember still from Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I believe what Anita had to say, read about it every single day. Clarence sits on the highest court, ruling on laws of all sorts. Confirming him was unjust, not a word he says that I can trust. Newspapers, 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 I'm addicted to you.
Well, back in 1990, I guess it's around 1997, I started working in LGBT radio. I fell into it. And what I fell into was an already rich legacy of gay press in America and around the world. And if we were pioneers in 1997, imagine 10, 20 years before even Lesbi Gay Radio, what those people were pioneering. Well, Tracy Baim, the publisher of Windy City Times, has had a rare and lengthy vantage point of working in the gay press for over 25 years. And she has a new book called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of the LGBT Community Newspapers in America. And it gives us a history of gay press, its impact, its deficiencies, its struggle to create community for us and to maintain a voice or LGBT people. And I'm thrilled to have Tracy on the Queercast with me today. Hey, Tracy, how are you?
Hi, very good. Thanks for having me on.
I have to tell you, you have become prolific. It's, I mean, I know you. We email many, many times in a week. And every now and again, you give birth to like a massive undertaking that I'm shocked with. So first of all, I just have to acknowledge the gay power you seem to have or harness. And in being a historian and really giving back to this community. So first of all, let me just say thank you for doing that.
Thanks a lot. I feel this sense of urgency to capture our history while we can, while my memory's still intact and while other people still remember as well.
Well, you're not only capturing the history, but you're also a voice of the right here, right now, what's going on. And I appreciate you being on in a previous show about, we talked about Jodie Foster. Do you consider yourself as much a historian as you do a journalist? You have had previous book, one of which was your book, you know, Out and Proud in Chicago. It was an overview of Chicago's gay community. And now kind of looking at this historical timeline and growth of gay press, something that you've been in the middle of your entire career. Do you feel like a historian more than a journalist?
No, I definitely feel like a journalist who happens to then also do long form journalism that kind of saves our history in a different way. A few years ago, I really felt like there was this gap, especially acknowledging the work of prominent Chicagoans to the movement nationally and internationally. So I started to do interviews for a website I created called ChicagoGayHistory.org. And as part of that, I then started to think of more long-form ways to tell our stories. So the books I've done about five or six books at this point, including some with Owen Keenan, they're very much a journalistic approach to our history. So that our, for example, even just the way we write and the way we attribute our sources is within the stories themselves, not as thousands of footnotes in the back of the book, so that people know where we got the material, but kind of like if you're reading the New York Times and it says, you know, according to The Economist, blah, 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 that's how we do this. That's how I and Owen, we have done our books. So I do feel still like a journalist, but I felt like the newspapers were really just one way to tell our story,
right,
and not a way that was as user-friendly to people who were trying to put it all together in one place. I felt it was all put together in my head, but I wanted to kind of take that out of my head and put it onto pages that were more accessible to the next generation.
Well, what influenced, let's start with you, what influenced your life in journalism?
Well, absolutely my parents. My mom, Joy Darrow, was a journalist her whole life, and she had interviewed Fidel Castro in the mountains of Cuba before the revolution. She had, you know, covered a wide range of local and national stories throughout her career, and she was at the Tribune in the 60s and was kind of forced out because women were not allowed to do serious news. She had taken photos and covered a lot of Martin Luther King's demonstrations in Chicago, the 68 riots at the Democratic Convention, and I was born in 63, so I got to witness my mother doing a lot of that work. My stepfather, meanwhile, had been at the Chicago Tribune for ultimately 29 years until he retired in the 90s. So both of them influenced me both in an alternative way with my mother and then mainstream my stepfather. My mom also then was managing editor of the Chicago Defender for a decade, and when I was 10 years old in 1973, I actually had my very first published article in a mainstream paper at the Chicago Defender. Wow. It was a kid's consumer column. So I had the bug very early. I used to do huge poster boards of mastheads and the banners of logos of magazines. I was just so fascinated with typesetting and fonts and the production side, as well as the writing and photography. Mm-hmm. You know, I just feel like I was really lucky. I had my calling early, and then I still get to do, 40 years later, I get to still do what I love.
Yeah. Wow. And you've seen, at least from those design elements, that change radically and expand so, so much. How did you know that it would be a life spent in GLBT journalism? Or was that just going to be your foray in?
Well, I was openly gay near the end of my high school at Lane Tech High School in Chicago, but I didn't really write about that kind of stuff. And in college, I didn't work for the mainstream student paper. I created a women's publication. And what I really thought was I'd probably go into feminist journalism, but I didn't really get an understanding of what existed out there until I graduated in 1984, and my mother heard of a part-time job at Gay Life newspaper, and I was like, there's a gay newspaper? I mean, I didn't really know that. I was in Des Moines, Iowa for college, so I wasn't in Chicago to even understand what was going on. I knew I was gay, but I just didn't know what existed in the universe. There was no internet, so I just didn't know. So as soon as I started at Gay Life newspaper, I was part-time, and then I, within a year, was managing editor full-time, and I never looked back. I felt so lucky to be out and gay at and doing what I love. And most people, most of my peers were closeted. And the Chicago Tribune, for example, and sometimes they couldn't have opened the gay reporters at that point. They didn't want it. There were gay reporters. They just weren't out of the closet. And I felt like I could never stifle myself that way and was really lucky to patch together this alternative career. It's really not for everybody. I mean, it's horrible pay. It's horrible hours. And, you know, really, you know more than I do. You know, we just struggle. We work 24/7, 365 on LGBT work. And if you don't, if it's not your passion and you almost treat it like both your work and your volunteer effort, you're going to leave. And that's fine. I've worked with really tremendous people over the years that it wasn't for them. It was kind of a kickoff for their careers, and they've gone into great things. But for me, I feel lucky that I've been able to sustain it. The book talks about how, you know, what's the future, and nobody knows what the future is. So I feel like if I eventually can't do this full-time, I will still always do it at least part-time and do something else to pay the bills.
Yeah. What is the birth of the gay press, do you think? What is the spark, the ember that started it all?
Well, the first documented publication in the United States was actually in Chicago by a man named Henry Gerber. He created a Friendship and Freedom newsletter for his peers and was obviously way ahead of his time. He was arrested by postal authorities for creating obscene materials, and so they only were able to put out two issues. Then fast forward a few years, a woman who used the pseudonym Lisa Benn created Vice Versa in the 1940s. It was the first lesbian newsletter, lasted about 9 or 10 issues. That wasn't that big and sustainable. But then in the 1950s, as a response to the lack of coverage or horrible coverage, either way, in the mainstream media, three publications started that were really the most long-lasting, and they then were the sparks for the next generation of gay media. And those were one magazine, the Mattachine Review, and The Ladder, which was put out by Daughters of Bilitis, a lesbian organization. All three of those were somewhat national. They were connected to nonprofit organizations that put them out for their members. And then they fed into the 1960s, more radicalizing gay press. And those, again, fed into the 1970s. So that's what the book documents, kind of this one publication begat the next publication, mm-hmm. begat the next. It wasn't really a linear. It was more like a blob moving along history. Mm-hmm. But it really was, it definitely, you can see that they were the kind of ancestors to the gay press that we have today.
You follow in one section of the book a number of publications. I think it's like a dozen or 10 over their history. You don't have to list all of them, but can you tell us who some of those are, and are they all still in existence? What has, you know, been kind of the thing that's made them successful or that came to their demise?
Right. The 10 publications that we do a special in-depth are all ones that are still publishing. There are lots of publications that we mentioned in the book that are no longer around, but I wanted to focus on 10 that were relatively long-lasting or at least had other things to say. So some of them are relatively new, and they are part of a long line of history in their own town. So Atlanta and New York are relatively new, but I wanted to show their own histories. The longer publications are the Bayer Reporter, the Washington Blade, and the Philadelphia Gay News. Those three publications are going on either just over four decades or just under four decades, and are amazing in how they've been able to sustain over time. They've been fortunate enough to be in large cities, but that isn't always the reason they succeeded. New York has had very much trouble keeping and sustaining the same publication over time. So really, with Philadelphia Gay News, it was the chutzpah of Mark Siegel, who's the publisher and founder. With Bayer Reporter, they had a longtime founder who died, and then his business partner took over. And the Washington Blade has had its own tumult over the years, and more recently went into a bankruptcy, and then was bought back by employees. So each of the papers talk about their own trajectory over time, and I also write an essay about Windy City Times, how it was founded in 1985 and its own really crazy history.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to just give examples across the country from Los Angeles to New York and San Francisco to Detroit, showing what the difference happened in those regional papers. Because I really feel like the regional gay press was very much hand-in-hand with the activist community. The national gay media, like The Advocate, for example, which I do mention in the book, had a different focus. They were trying to be this national in scope once they moved out of just being a Los Angeles publication. So they served this more generic national community. But the regional gay newspapers, I feel like, because they were weekly publications in most cases, freely distributed, that they had far more impact in any one city than The Advocate could nationally, which was a paid subscription-based publication. So that's why I wanted to focus on the regional gay papers, because of how in-depth they covered their communities.
Right. And I know that you also, I mean, obviously writing about, you know, Windy City Times, you bring your personal perspective to it. But, you know, the book does include essays that kind of give more of an editorial perspective of the gay movement and gay news. And I don't know. You know, I wonder how the question that kind of came to me, because I'm sure you put that in there, so there was a personal and intimate and editorial quality to the history you're writing. But I started thinking, how can GLBT news and press not ultimately be personal? And it's something that we strive for in journalism, is to not be personal, but it's rooted in something so personal. And I just want to know what you thought about that.
Well, I think especially in the early days of gay media and probably the kind of heyday of it was 1970s, when you had all these activists starting publications out of such a passion for their community that you couldn't help but take everything personal and be personal.
Yep.
So the take everything personal was probably the rough part of our community.
Right.
The infighting and the battles over starting new papers and the negative stuff that happened within our community was very damaging to people individually and to companies. But because we were such a raw and new movement.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that was very personal and a difficult time for many of those writers who tried to be journalists, but at the same time, they were covering their own community.
Right.
And how do we do that when there's some good in our community and there's definitely some really bad stuff in our community? Not only the crime that we commit against ourselves, domestic violence and all those other kinds of things that go with that, but also just, you know, the whole AIDS crisis, for example. That was a very, obviously, we were covering our brothers and sisters dying.
Right.
I would take a photo of somebody one week, and I knew that was the photo I was going to use in their obit the next week. How is that not personal to your life and what you're doing? So I knew early on, even as a teenager, that there was no such thing as journalistic objectivity. So while I know that there's a struggle in a mainstream context, I never kidded myself that as a white lesbian that I don't have biases that I have to overcome. And I think that journalism as a whole did a disservice to generations of journalists by claiming that there even was such a thing as objectivity. If you teach people there is such a thing as that, then they're not going to assess their own bias coming in as a white straight man covering an African-American leader in Atlanta. You know, you have to assess your bias and check yourself at all times to try to cover the community you're covering, whatever that is, whether it's the police beat or City Hall. So I feel like I've never really struggled very much with that issue of this is personal. You know, when I, especially in the 1980s, coming into the community covering it as AIDS crisis was peaking and the gay movement was also at this huge position with the March on Washington and the gay rights movement in Chicago, I just moved. You know what I mean? Like, I just moved forward at every step of the way and was not doing a lot of self-assessment. I just knew that I had to cover everything I could at that moment in time and assess it later. That's why I feel like I'm doing these history books now, is it's a point of time for me to look back and say, well, yeah, that really was, as you say, very personal. There were lots of painful things about it, but there were lots of very great things about it. And I want to remember both. I don't want to gloss over the bad stuff that happened, but I also want to remember that I still made the right decision for myself, not working at the Tribune
or New York Times
or anywhere else. I would never have fit in those environments.
Yeah. How is the gay press changing today? You know, how is it being forced to change? And I don't know that that's a different question than mainstream print press, but press now encompasses so much more. So you've always been really at the forefront and at the advent of social media. How are we having to change as well?
Well, you know, Windy City Times, which actually the predecessor Outlines newspaper, went online in 1995. We were one of the first few gay papers in the country that went online. We were never afraid of the internet because we already were a free publication in print. We just felt like online allowed us for much more opportunity, especially in the 2000s when it became even easier to put on photos and video and audio, like with the podcast. That was never something we feared. So we really built a brand very early on online, and I think some gay media did not. They were afraid of it. And actually today it's still the case where we make zero money online compared to our costs. It's a loss. We lose money for our online efforts, but it still was very important for us to keep that brand identity online because our competition, our advertisers and our competition are paying very much attention to that,
right.
Which is why we still stay as a print publication, because that's where the revenues are that pay for our entire company. What I was depressed at in assessing the state of the gay press movement is how few papers are left. I didn't even realize how many had closed in the last decade until I was really researching this book intently. Some have come back, but many of them are gone away permanently or gone online permanently. And I think what that does is what we have is a really thriving online gay media universe. You can get a lot of different gay and lesbian voices online, but they're very much individual voices. There's very few that are multi-staffed publication centers where you have a website that isn't just more than one or two people's voices. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a risk. When those people burn out, the continuity is lost. And when you have a larger company, you have more voices that add to the table. In any one month in our print edition and online, we have more than 50 bylines of different writers who are contributing to our company and on the podcast, et cetera. So that gives you just a stronger community and a stronger sense of coverage, et cetera. So I do worry about that. There's only 12 weekly gay newspapers left, 13 biweekly, and overall there's about 120 gay and lesbian print publications left in the country, regional and national. So that's pitiful. It used to be hundreds more, and as there are fewer and fewer of them, it becomes less of a viable alternative for advertisers as well as for the news. And so I really feel like the book was meant to say kind of a call for a discussion of how do we get to the next place, whether that's through foundation money, through other streams of revenue, in working together. I'm not sure what that'll be. There is a National Gay Media Association now that it probably will meet sometime this year that'll discuss these things. But I don't think any one of our papers has an answer. Fortunately, the 12 weeklies that are left are really, I think, strong publishers and strong business models.
Yep.
So I think we're not going to have as much loss over the next couple of years as we did the last 10 years. We're kind of, the ones that are left are stronger for surviving, but none of us really knows what the future holds because all of the regional prints are free publications.
Right.
So we're we're very much dependent on advertising revenue to survive.
Well, and it seems like it, we're in an age where people kind of feel like, well, I shouldn't have to pay for music. I shouldn't have to pay for information. I shouldn't have to pay for content. I should, you know, be able to watch a, you know, a television episode on the web and not pay for it, or wait and then not pay for it. So, I mean, we're kind of at an, you know, this entitled aspect of, you know, just wanting this information. And I know it's a huge conversation with journalists in general, and mainstream media as well. Do you think, you know, we have these, as you said, these dozen very strong national weekly GLBT publications, and you know, and they have obviously multimedia arms as well. But the big question has always been, and I remember it coming up even in the 90s when I was on the radio station, and at that time, Lesbi Gay Radio was the only national daily gay radio show. And now if you, you know, now there's a gazillion podcasts and radio shows and other things. But do you think that we will reach a time with greater equality, greater visibility, greater voice, greater understanding of GLBT people, that gay media, gay press, gay specific publications become obsolete?
Well, I guess the only comparison I have is if you look what's available for the Latino community or the African-American community, even in the feminist community, I feel like niche publications are really the safest for the future to still exist. Mm-hmm. It's the general mainstream publications that are having a harder and harder time justifying their existence, because there are so much competing people talking about Beyonce allegedly lip-syncing or Jodie Foster coming out in the mainstream environment. I think the gay press still has a very important role to play, including monitoring what's going on in our gay community and our nonprofit and business communities. You know, we've done investigations over the last year that have been critical to making our organizations more accountable to their clients and their donors. Yeah. The Howard Brown Health Center and the Gerber Heart Library, both those investigations were not done by the mainstream. In fact, the mainstream touted Howard Brown and even gave Crane Chicago Business gave him an award as a 40 under 40. And then they had to retract it later. And had they just looked on our website, they had seen that there were lots of problems that were unaddressed at Howard Brown and Gerber Heart Library, et cetera. So I think actually what's happening is the mainstream media, is they have fewer and fewer reporters because they're laying off people. They have fewer resources to cover these niche communities. They're stuck covering the mainstream stuff. And so the niche community papers actually serve an even stronger role at self-monitoring the community and the things that go on. So I think the donor community, the corporate community, et cetera, needs to understand how important these niche papers are within the African-American, Latino, gay, et cetera, in monitoring the organizations they're giving money to.
Mm-hmm.
The mainstream media has never done that, not on an in-depth, long-term basis. They parachute into stories, but they cannot cover the community the same way. They just don't have the resources to do it the way we can. We complement one another in a way, because certainly the mainstream media is better than it used to be, but they just can't cover any one individual community the way that the niche papers can.
Yeah. So, you know, we learn from our history. You've been covering our history. So, and your most recent book before, Gay Press, Gay Power, was Obama and the Gays, A Political Marriage. And I just want to ask you, because we're fresh off the inauguration and launching into the beginning of this second term, and many people say he has limited time to do what he's going to do in this, you know, in this second term. If people called Clinton the black president, I guess Obama's the closest thing we've had to a gay president. How is Obama doing on our issues, and what does he need to do for us in this second term?
Well, one thing Obama always says is he's not here to be the king of the world. He's an ally, so he needs us to continue to push and work as well. And that was, I think, the mistake some people made in his first 2 years, and that's why the Republicans took over Congress in his midterms, because it was never an individual effort. It's a team effort. But the things that I certainly know that he's been the absolute most comprehensive and best president on LGBT issues than ever existed before. And what he has in front of him are things like continuing to have his Justice Department maybe file amicus briefs on behalf of marriage with the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. also supporting Employment Non-Discrimination Act, transgender inclusive, and there are some executive orders that he can possibly do to make it better for the military on partnership benefits for LGB partners, and then also the military needs to be better on transgender issues. So there definitely are things that will happen over the next couple of years. You know, overall, strengthening the healthcare agenda is really critical for the gay community in a way that people don't understand, not just about HIV, but all sorts of health issues that affect our community. Obamacare was just really a first step to what we really need, which is a public option. And I hope the LGBT movement gets further behind that, because for the entire country, the healthcare whole system is hurting all of us. But I know that it particularly is hurting the LGBT community in terms of being able to get equality of coverage and access to health care.
Yeah. Well, we got to keep our momentum behind him and the inclusiveness that we are finally hearing, at least from this presidency, and see what we can do with it. As you said, we need to move with urgency, which is something you've been giving us an example of for many decades. So the book is called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. It's by Tracy Baim. It's available on Amazon.com, createspace.com. We'll have both of those linked in our show notes. And if you're in the Chicago area, you can pick it up at Women and Children First in Andersonville or Unabridged Books in Boys Town in Lakeview. And Tracy, I really appreciate you being a person who has this sense of urgency and capturing our history and also capturing the stories as they come day to day.
Thanks very much for having me again.
Got something to say? Call us today, 312-21-BE-GAY.
Well, everyone, I hope you have a sense of urgency this week. Thank you for listening to the Queercast. Maybe share the Queercast with one or two friends. Tell them, hey, I listen. I think you should listen. Put it on your Facebook page or send an email out and help us attract some new listeners in 2013. We would appreciate it. And I want to thank Tracy Baim for being on with us. Don't forget to pick up her book at Amazon.com or createspace.com or one of our GLBT bookstores here in Chicago. If you live in the city, Women and Children First and Unabridged Books. I hope you know you're a part of a movement. Just even listening to this, you're a part of the movement. You're a part of our story just by receiving it and hearing our stories every week. And we appreciate that. And be sure to continue to support your GLBT press so we can continue bringing the stories to you. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast, queer and now.